Hi, Professor Benton. Thank you so much for coming and being here with us today.
Yeah, great pleasure. Good to have a chat, Dave.
Right. So we've seen a bit about the terrestrialization of vertebrates. What were some of the challenges that they needed to overcome to make that move from water onto land?
Yeah, when we think about this, of course, we think of a modern fish and we think of a modern tetrapod. And so the first thing we think that's really important is breathing oxygen rather than in air, you know, rather than extracting it from the water through their gills.
Hmm.
But actually, when we look at the fossil evidence, we realize that that's probably not the main challenge, because a lot of these early fishes in the Paleozoic had some kind of lung already, as far as we know. And perhaps the sarcopterygian fishes, that particular group of lobe-finned fishes from which the tetrapods arose, they probably already could do this to some extent, maybe a little bit like lungfish today. They could sort of flop around and have a huff and a puff in the air and survive for a certain amount of time. So actually the main challenge is support of the body. And we can see this today, of course, when whales are washed and dolphins washed up on the beach. They're tetrapods. They should be able to cope, but they can't because they suffocate. And so thinking back a step, when you are living in the water, you're neutrally buoyant, which means effectively you are not subject to gravity. Your body is in equilibrium, the tissues of the body in terms of support are in equilibrium with the water, and effectively, you could say you weigh nothing. But as soon as you crawl out of the water, you've got that terrible crushing effect of gravity. And that would have been a big issue for it back in the Devonian.
Okay, so, wow, it's amazing that, you know, like, fish would develop gills without even having been up onto land. That's fantastic. Do any fish today have these kind of like lungs?
Well, yes. I think the modern analogues would be lungfish, which are there's only a small number of species today living in Australia, Southern Africa, and South America. And maybe we're overly reliant on those as a kind of model of what was happening in the Devonian. But I think it's a useful modern analogue. And these lungfishes live in seasonal, hot tropical conditions where at certain times of the year there's heavy rainfall, typically monsoonal type rain, producing lots of ponds and rivers that they're very happy to live in. And then at other times of the year it dries up and the water disappears, and that's the point at which they flop around from pond to pond, breathing air and then lurching into a pond where they can survive underwater for a bit. And eventually, of course, we know today they aestivate, the opposite of hibernate. They live out the summer in a sort of sealed mucus ball underground and just almost turning off until the rains come again. And so really all the time people have been thinking about this all the way back to Al Romer, maybe as much as nearly 100 years ago, have been thinking that this is roughly what was happening in the Devonian. The climates were maybe similar, and the need to remain in the water was similar. You're sort of protected when you're underwater, or at least protected from drying out, and in various other ways, the neutral buoyancy is a good positive thing. Crawling onto land in an ironic manner was simply to get back into the water.
Hmm. So how did we end up going from a fin to a limb? How does that transition work? Because, you know, like a limb isn't going to be that good in the water. A fin's not going to be that good on the land.
Yeah.
Do you just like go step by step in this evolution as you progressively live more associated with the land? Or do you like have a fin that's adapted for a special purpose underwater that then you discover, oh, wait, this is actually good for land, and you just re-employ it in a different manner.
That's right. I think, again, the modern lungfishes are a helpful analog, but I think luckily in this case, because, of course, limbs have skeletons, we can use the fossils as well. So I'll refer to the fossils now, and I think we can go back to the Devonian. And there's a whole series. We're so lucky. This is one of those big transitions, which is really very well documented by a whole series of fossils. At one end, you've got animals that you would say, this is definitely a fish. Nobody would argue, something like Eusthenopteron, which is known from complete skeletons from Canada and the Baltic. And this is a kind of meter-long lungfish of sorts, and already had fleshy fins. So the lobe fins, the sarcopterygians, didn't have the ray fins that we're familiar with in most other kinds of bony fish, where they just have thin rods of bone purely to support the structure of the fin. They don't have muscles. There's no ability to particularly use them in locomotion. Whereas Eusthenopteron, back in the early and middle Devonian, even underwater, living most of its life underwater, could actually use these fins, we're pretty sure, to sort of push its way along the bottom of a pond, pull its way through vegetation, even perhaps drag itself through the mud for a short distance out of the water. We're not sure. But in that, in the fleshy part of the fin, you can actually see precursors of the key bones in our leg or arm. And then there's a series of fossils, as I mentioned. The next one that's really important is called Tiktaalik, which is from Arctic Canada. And this was studied in a huge amount of detail by Neil Shubin and various others in North America. And it's kind of one step forward. The bones in the front fin and the back fin are more comparable to those in the limb of a tetrapod. You can see, for example, in the forelimb, the humerus, the radius, the ulna. There's even the beginnings of a sort of wrist, and beyond that, nothing much comparable. But it's been calculated that the musculature would have certainly been enough that Tiktaalik could have raised its head and could have moved on land. And the big change between Eusthenopteron and Tiktaalik is that the shoulder girdle and the skull have separated. So in a fish, the forefin, the front paddle, is more or less kind of connected to the back of the head, whereas in Tiktaalik, these extra bones around the back of the head are fully separated, forming a separate shoulder girdle. And that's probably quite important, because when you're swimming, it doesn't matter. But when you're actually bouncing around on land, it's a more episodic, jerky kind of movement compared to swimming. And that separation of the head and the shoulder girdle was really important, because it allows you to jerk along as you drag yourself fitfully across the muddy land without shaking up the entire head at the same time.
Oh, wow. Okay, so were these very first vertebrates to walk on land, were they amphibians or were they just amphibious? What's the difference?
We would say Tiktaalik is a tetrapodomorph, meaning it's almost a tetrapod, but not quite. So it belongs to a definite clade, a definite monophyletic group in the scheme of things. We would say it's amphibious. Yes, you're right to make the distinction, because it can live underwater and on land. How long for on land, we don't really know. We have to go forward in time a few notches and come up with something like Acanthostega or Ichthyostega. These are very famous early tetrapods. They are classed as tetrapods, members of the clade Tetrapoda. Whether you could call them amphibians as well, that would be a moot point. They're somewhere at the root of tetrapods anyway. And they had much more differentiated limbs. But amazingly, they still hadn't really shaken free of the water. And it's very important, actually, bouncing ahead, even looking at modern amphibians like frogs and salamanders. They've left a lot of life modes unresolved. Remember, of course, they give birth to generally young in the water, so they're still rather fish-like in reproduction, these, of course, tadpoles. And in some of their sensory systems and in terms of water balance and the nature of their skin, and even in terms of their respiration, modern amphibians, like frogs and salamanders, are still not fully grasping the need for transformation. They haven't done the whole job. But that was okay. That was enough. And, of course, we project back into the Devonian, that these very first tetrapods on land, like Acanthostega and Ichthyostega, they still had not resolved everything, and they still lived in the water. And in fact, Acanthostega and Ichthyostega got rather large paddle-like limbs, so they were more swimmers than walkers.
And just to clarify some of the groups, because it's we speak about a lot when we're looking at these animals. We've got fish, we've got tetrapods, amphibians, amniotes, reptiles, mammal-like reptiles. There's so much going on, and so many of these groups are nested within the other groups. So which are the main groups, and what are the differences?
So I suppose in this whole story, we care about the Sarcopterygii. That's one clade which includes all of the living lungfishes, the coelacanths, that wonderful living fossil, so-called, from the deep ocean, as well as many of these Devonian forms and all the tetrapods. Next up, we care about...
Sorry, were those the lobe fin fishes?
Yeah, they're the lobe fin fishes. Yes, thank you. And then the next up are the tetrapodomorpha, which is another big clade that includes Tiktaalik plus all the tetrapods, but not those more fishy types. And then the tetrapoda are Ichthyostega, Acanthostega, and everything above them in the cladogram. And then we go up to amniota if we want to get to the clade where we're looking at full adaptation to life on land. So tetrapoda, including Ichthyostega, Acanthostega, they had evolved the mode of support. They could support their body out of the water. They could overcome gravity. Secondly, they had the limbs to enable them to move around. But that was about it. They were still feeding underwater using suction feeding, which is you've got a big mouth and you open it fast and food comes rushing in. That works beautifully underwater. It doesn't really work on land. As you do an experiment, if you like, you know, put a cookie on the edge of the table and stand right in front of it with your mouth shut tight. Open your mouth as fast as you can. Will that cookie jump into your mouth? Probably not. Whereas if you did that underwater, it might very well do so because the fluid medium enables you to do that. You go further up, then amniota, then are reptiles plus birds plus mammals. And this is a really important clade further up the tree, excluding amphibians and fishes. Because, of course, amniota did the final things. They reproduce on land by laying eggs or producing live young. And they feed on land. They don't go back. Generally, don't go back into the water for food. They run around catching insects or biting leaves and stuff like that. And their skin is waterproof, whereas that of the earlier tetrapods probably generally is not. And so they've made the transition fully. So we kind of think of it as a three or four step process. Sarcopterygians and tetrapodomorphs in the early Devonian, middle Devonian. Tetrapods in the late Devonian, amniotes finally probably in the late Carboniferous. So it's, you know, it took about 50, 60 million years for all of these steps to work through before you could say, here we actually have some properly land-adapted vertebrates that really are adapted to living away from the water properly.
Yeah, I think it really is worth, like, emphasizing how long of a process it is, because it's very easy to just say, like, and then animals came out, then vertebrates came out of the water and terrestrialized, became land dwelling, and you just kind of gloss over that whole drawn out process.
And the focus, of course, we think, of course, when we jump into the water, we realize you can't breathe underwater. Oh my God. But of course, in terms of what was going on in the Devonian, that was the least of their concerns.
Right. So anyway, we've got them out of water now. We have our amniotes. We've kind of severed the reproductive and feeding dependency on the water, and we are now living on the land. So which are the groups of amniotes, and how did they fare throughout the rest of the Paleozoic era?
Yes, so it seems that amniotes divided into two major groups pretty early on. And those groups are the reptilia, or the reptiles on one hand, which today include lizards and crocodiles and birds and so on, and the synapsids on the other hand, which led eventually through to mammals. But there were a whole diversity of groups within these two lines, these two lineages that we can follow through the Carboniferous. So genomics experts, molecular biologists, they like to look at the ultimate ancestry between birds on the one hand and mammals on the other. And in fact, those are the pinnacle of each of these branches, if you like, and you track them back and you get a date of something like 320, 325 million years ago. That was the point at which the ultimate ancestor of birds separated from the ultimate ancestor of mammals. And I think now people use the word reptile to represent the bird line because it includes all these fossil forms we would call reptiles, including dinosaurs, including crocodiles and lizards. And on the other hand, we would use the term synapsid for the whole group leading on to mammals. And so actually the story between these two lines has been a kind of long-term dance. The synapsids did best in the Permian, and they were probably the most abundant and diverse, whereas the reptiles were kind of a little bit low-key. They were quite small. I'll talk in a moment about that. And then with the rise of the dinosaurs eventually in the Triassic, that was the best period for the reptile branch. And during the Mesozoic, of course, dinosaurs got huge. They dominated the landscape. They gave rise to birds and all sorts of other groups. And then eventually at the end of the Cretaceous, back come the synapsids and the dinosaurs disappear. The mammals come to the fore. Although today, of course, we've got birds, crocodiles, and lizards, which are highly successful on the reptile side. But during the late Carboniferous and the Permian, I think mostly people look at the climate and they think, okay, yeah, you know, the amniotes came on the scene at the time of the great Carboniferous rainforests, or at least forests. And so we visualize those as a time of considerable humidity and considerable richness of life. And yet towards the end of the Carboniferous, those great forests largely disappeared. And in many parts of the world, the climates became much more arid, much more dry. And this is represented by red beds, so-called. They can, in different parts of the world, where you find the fossils. And in those conditions, the reptiles had an advantage because they can live in conditions of less water than mammals and synapsids in general. And so during the Permian, various groups of both synapsids and reptiles did quite well. And indeed, at the end of the Permian, in fact, the landscape was kind of, the animals you would have seen included pariosaurs, which are on the reptile side. They got to be very big. They were herbivores, some of them maybe weighing as much as a ton. And then at the top of the food chain on the carnivore side were actually synapsids, such as the Gorgonopsians, which were adapted to preying upon these giant, thick-skinned pariosaurs. The Gorgonopsians even had saber teeth, and so they are very dramatic members of the community. Then all the other creatures in the landscape were somewhat smaller, feeding variously on plants and insects and et cetera, et cetera. So that's what we had through the Permian and towards the end of the Permian.
Wow, it sounds like quite a rich ecosystem, loads of things going on.
Yes, and very alien, somewhat different from what we're used to today.
Right, so let's kill them all the Permo-Triassic mass extinction. How was this extinction first identified? Not like what were the events that happened, but like as scientists, how did paleontologists first come to recognize this extinction event?
Yeah, it was quite a long process of finally admitting that this had happened, which is ironic because we now know that it was the biggest mass extinction of all time. But invertebrate paleontologists, of course, through Victorian times, were using their fossils to a great extent for biostratigraphy. So they were interested in looking at the ranges of different types of fossils. And so as long ago as maybe the 1860s, various paleontologists like John Phillips, the professor of geology in Oxford, had noticed a big change. And he named the Paleozoic and the Mesozoic. And part of his evidence for that was that there was a big change in the fossils. And he was, though, thinking just in terms of biostratigraphy. And I don't think the idea of a mass extinction really existed, even though the fossils had changed kind of wholesale. And he also noticed the end of the Mesozoic, the disappearance of ammonites and dinosaurs, et cetera, et cetera. And then the Cenozoic starting with different fossil types. And when I started in the field back in the 1980s and 90s, people knew all of that, but they were kind of in denial. Many were kind of saying, oh, well, you know, something was happening, but we're not really sure. It's quite a long, drawn-out process, and maybe it's a sampling issue. We're looking at stuff in different parts of the world. And I think the invertebrate paleontologists had fully accepted the nature of the extinction event, thanks to the work of Jack Sepkoski and others in documenting the marine fossil record. But I do remember that the standard vertebrate paleontology textbook said nothing about it, even though they kind of said, oh, yeah, the pariasaurs disappear, the gorgonopsians disappear, oh, yeah, and the dinosaurs pop up onto the scene in the Triassic and lots of new groups. But they were still kind of denying it and saying, oh, well, maybe this was a long process that lasted 20 or 30 million years. So, you know, kind of nothing to see here. And I was always a bit dubious about that. But the evidence wasn't that great. You know, we couldn't provide good quality dating of particularly the terrestrial successions in the Karoo of South Africa, in Russia, in China, in other places where you can see the boundary. And so it really took until maybe 15 or 20 years ago before people finally admitted it and said, yes, this really is happening. And this really is the biggest extinction event of all time. And it isn't just the invertebrates in the oceans. It is terrestrial vertebrates on land. And I think now everybody fully accepts it. And the quality of the data, the volume of data that we have kind of confirms it very clearly.
It's astounding that an event so big and so significant to life on Earth could only have really been figured out in the last few decades. It's something that you feel people would have known about for, you know, hundreds of years.
Yeah, I think it's partly the tradition was not to be a catastrophist, not to, you know, and there's a similar outcry in a way back in 1980 when the famous Alvarez paper was published about the impact of the asteroid at the end of the Cretaceous. A lot of paleontologists are, ooh, this is too much. We can't go this far. And indeed, for the Permian, nobody was even suggesting an asteroid. You know, people were actually just talking about climate change and volcanic eruptions and this, that, and the other. So, but yeah, I know it is amazing. And I suppose it was just, you don't want to look foolish. You don't want to say anything too dramatic or remarkable. And yet, nonetheless, there it was.
Okay, so looking at the extinction event then, what were some of the contributing factors?
I think now people have a pretty clear idea of the model. They may emphasize different aspects, but I think we can say from the start there's very little evidence at the moment for any kind of an impact event that could explain it. I think everybody looks towards the Siberian traps, the basalt rocks in Siberia, in Russia, where enormous volumes, you know, millions of cubic kilometers of lava were belched out over the span of a million years or so, spanning across the PT boundary. So the eruptions actually began in the latest Permian, and they kept on burping away through the PT boundary into the Triassic and continued to erupt. And there were certain peaks of eruption, like bang on the, or more or less on the Permian-Triassic boundary, and at different points through that time. And it's what's called now a hyperthermal, meaning high temperature. And I think we can characterize that particularly in terms of the the gases that are coming out of the volcanoes. And these are long fissure volcanoes covering a great area. This is not like Vesuvius or Etna, just a single pointy volcano going boom and out it comes. This is covering a huge area like on Iceland, but, you know, on steroids. And generating lava locally, regionally, but it's the gases. It's particularly the carbon dioxide and the methane and water vapor. Those are all greenhouse gases that give you a great deal of elevated temperature. And at the same time, they and sulfur dioxide mixing with water and oxygen give you acid. So initially, in the initial phases of the eruption, there can be a lot of acid rain, as we've seen with Mount St. Helens and lots of other smaller eruptions today. And of course, the acid rain has effects on land and in the ocean. On land, it kills the forests. And we already kind of knew that paleontologists had identified a coal gap of about 10 million years of the early Triassic and middle Triassic, where there's no evidence of forests. They've gone, they've been killed. And that's the acid rain. And then the acid leaks into the and falls as water into the shallow marine setting. And we know about ocean acidification today. This stresses many of the key marine organisms, corals, brachiopods, bivalves, gastropods, crustaceans, anything with a skeleton made of calcium carbonate, of which all of those have those skeletons. Any acidification of the ocean attacks them and makes them very unhappy. They want to get away from it. Coupled with the warming that comes from the carbon dioxide and methane. And the current measurements of carbon and oxygen isotopes indicate that temperatures went up by anything from 10 to 15 degrees C. And those high temperatures were maintained all the way through the early Triassic, pretty much. Maybe pulsing a bit, but they were retained high for maybe 5 or 6 million years. So this was super grim. But it started at the PT boundary, and that's where the first big extinctions were happening. And it's enough. The heating and the acid rain were enough to clear the landscapes, give you a kind of rocky landscape on land. Nothing much could survive. And the oceans were swamped by all this organic matter and other stuff being washed in off the land, including minerals being weathered, sulfur, nitrogen, phosphorus. So the oceans were swamped with nutrients, and that led to a kind of strangulation of the oceans at the same time as heating of surface waters, driving the thermocline down, breaking the normal circulation of ocean water, where deep water comes bubbling up and gets oxygen at the surface and goes cycling right down again to the ocean floor, bringing the oxygen down. All of that was sort of brought to an end. And this is the kind of killing model, which kind of kills everything pretty much. And it's on the scale that was happening at that time. We can sort of match that 15 degree temperature rise, 95% loss of species in the oceans and on land.
95%?
Yes. Biggest of all time. One in 20 species survive. You know, it's the worst you could imagine, short of total annihilation.
And so which groups did we actually lose?
So amongst the vertebrates, we lose a lot of the synapsids, including the Gorgonopsians, but many other groups went. Amongst the reptiles, we're losing the pariasaurs and many others as well. In the oceans, the trilobites and rugose and tabulate corals, the favorites of your Paleozoic paleontology class. Many of the brachiopods disappeared, and virtually all groups were really hit very hard. And some were totally driven to extinction. Others, maybe one or two species out of 100 would survive. And then variously in the Triassic, certain groups recovered. But, you know, the structural losses were really important. The loss of forests, that had never happened before, and not since. And in the oceans, the total loss of reefs, you know, you just totally lose coral reefs. And so it's not just the loss of species, you're actually losing whole species-rich biodiversity hotspots like tropical forests and reefs. They just disappear.
Well, I think that, you know, everything that is alive today, everything came through that extinction event. Otherwise, it would have been extinct and we wouldn't have it. So were the things that we have today, were they relatively untouched? Or did they also get really hit as well? Was it like a bottlenecking of diversity?
Yes, I think the term bottleneck is useful because I think it was largely chance what survived. This is very much what David Raup called a field of bullets, which is you can look as hard as you like for explanations why this species survived and this one didn't. But he likened it to the First World War, where all the soldiers come out of the trenches and they run out against the enemy. And it doesn't matter whether you are, you're muscular and well-trained and you had a good diet versus the soldier who has not. you're just as likely to be shot because the field of bullets is non-selective. Everybody gets shot. And so the heating and the acid and all the other stuff that was going on was so grim, so awful, that nearly everything could be liable to being killed. Of course, there are a few selection factors that help you to survive, like being widespread geographically or being relatively small, not being too big, having a relatively mixed kind of diet. Those help, but they don't ensure survival at that time. And so it's very interesting, and this is a research area that is only just beginning in a way, is looking at the early and early middle Triassic, this time of continuing grim conditions, where there were still lots of challenges, further extinctions, life recovering a bit, then getting hit again. How on earth do these different groups stagger through all of this torrent of challenges, if you like? You know, you get through the first one and then you're hit by another one a million years later. And so, yes, by all means, of course, the ancestors of modern mammals and modern birds, modern lizards, frogs, many modern, obviously all the groups of modern insects. And so a lot of this, though, we do track back to the Triassic. After the grim conditions had ceased, we see that the first of the modern types of conifers amongst plants, for example, various modern groups of ferns. We see various modern groups of insects, like some of the first flies, maybe the first butterflies. They appear in the late Triassic. Amongst the vertebrates, we see the first of the modern types of amphibians, frog-like creatures, maybe the first lizards, the first mammals, the first crocodiles. So a lot, you know, we can actually track a lot of modern groups back to this odd time at the end of the Triassic, where finally life on land and in the oceans is kind of stabilizing. And tracking back, yes, of course, some of their ancestors got through. Lots of other things got through, and then they bit the dust in the early Triassic. This is what I think David Jablonski called dead clade walking. They just survived, but not for long. And so there were further filters to survival going on in the early part of the Triassic. It was a real terrible, terrible bottleneck, using that term. Geneticists talk about a bottleneck, which is where a population size is massively reduced. And then you can track all of the modern organisms back to two or three individuals. And it is something like that in the early Triassic.
Was one of these dead clade walking, like they are doomed to extinction just a little bit later, would that be something like Lystrosaurus?
Yeah, definitely, because it was one of the survivors. And a lot of the other survivors that were just there somehow at the beginning of the Triassic, in those that weird world that must have been so strange, where somehow the carbon is there, the food is there, but there's nothing there to eat it. The whole system has just broken down. And we know Lystrosaurus, which is a sort of meter and a half long, rather pig-like herbivorous dicynodont, synapsid. There it was. It was everywhere in the world. But yeah, it didn't really give rise to any particular lineage. The later dicynodonts and other synapsids came from other sources.
Were there any organisms at this time that were just like, you know what, this is absolutely perfect, I'm having a whale of a time, they went crazy, there were tons of them? Are there any that these conditions actually suited?
I can't really think of any very good examples. I mean, Lystrosaurus comes close, and there are some mollusks like Claria, which are said to have been suited to the sort of dysoxic conditions, meaning low levels of oxygen on the seabed. And so certainly they flourished. And you know, when you look at earliest Triassic locations around the world, they're very boring. They're very much the same creatures, whether they're terrestrial or marine. And so in a sense, yes, there were these species like Lystrosaurus on land, like Claria, a kind of scallop, a thin-shelled scallop that's found in many marine locations. They did well. But they were probably not enormously happy. They were struggling. You know, food supplies were limited. Oxygen was maybe not abundant. And the conditions were rather hot to be comfortable. And so the world had not settled down. and so they couldn't really do much.
I guess it's important to think of them not in isolation, but as requiring, you know, a whole ecosystem around them to support them as well. And even if those conditions are good for you, or you can at least survive with them, the rest of the ecosystem around you is gone.
Yeah, that's right. Because, of course, the oceans, you know, the seabed couldn't be said to be normal for a long time. Likewise, the landscape that you would have seen if you went back in time to any point really in the early Triassic would have seemed very weird, because on land there were no trees, you know, there were no plants taller than a meter for a great span of time. And that was very weird because, of course, up to that point, there had been all kinds of evolution of trees in the Carboniferous and Permian, and they're all gone. And it took a while then for these various groups of conifers and others, lycopods and such like, to again develop the tree habit, evolve the tree habit. And on the bottom of the ocean, there were various kinds of sort of stromatolites, which are very weird, that you'd have thought were back in the Precambrian. What's going on? And reefs sort of recovered in a way at different points in the early Triassic, but there were not metazoan reefs. They were kind of algal reefs, so they didn't have any corals or bryozoans or echinoderms or mollusks forming the reef itself, the skeleton of the reef. And so, yeah, you were kind of, you know, the whole landscape lacked key structural components, which took maybe as long as 10 million years in some cases to come back.
That's quite a while. So let's try and leave it on as positive a note as we can.
Yeah, let's.
Is the positive just that life made it through?
I think there's two positives. One is that, which is the only thing we can say. If you had gone back in your time machine to that point, and you'd have thought, goodness me, is life actually going to survive this terrible thing? And yes, it did. And then, of course, the second positive, we look back from the present day. We care about ourselves, which probably we shouldn't do, but we do. And we care about human beings. We care then about the mammals. We care about synapsids. And so we can say, well, thank goodness some of the synapsids did survive through. They're our distant ancestors. But also looking around the biodiversity on Earth today, we can track a lot of the important groups that we see around us, plants and animals, as dating back to this time. And there is an opportunistic point because, of course, if this extinction had not happened, we can't necessarily say that these modern style groups would have had their opportunity. There's certainly a kind of effect that we're aware of, that if you have dominant plants and animals on land at any time, they can kind of rule the roost. There's a kind of incumbency, incumbent advantage, it's called. And until you remove them, just like when the dinosaurs were removed, eventually mammals got their chance. And likewise, probably certain of the modern groups we care about, like mammals, for goodness sake, and a number of others, might not have had their chance. So we could say that's another positive, that the Triassic was a time of revolution, a time of major change and origination of major new groups, and they are actually very important today.
All right. Thank you very much for talking us through that.
That's great. Yeah, thanks very much. Good to hear from you, Dave.